This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from Thursday, the 7th of April, lovingly curated as ever by our producer, Isa Havilio. Right, what have we got today? We're talking salaries. Here's the thing. The UAE Central Bank says, on average, we all got an 8% pay rise last year. Did you? We had a Twitter poll this morning. Nobody said they got a pay rise. 85% said their pay was flat. 15% said they had a pay cut. We got Trevor Murphy of the recruitment firm Cooper Fitch giving us his take on the job market at the moment. To be fair, he does say it is booming. What else have we got? Whistleblowing. We've got a new whistleblowing rule down in Dubai's financial centre. And Patrick Meaney of the regulator, the DFSA, is going to give us all the details on that. Talking economics with Ed Bell of Emirates NBD. Inflation, of course, rearing its ugly head. And finally, fascinating interview with the European billionaire Thomas Fleur. Now, he is the founder of VistaJet. It's a private jet company. It's based here in Dubai. Business is absolutely flying, pardon the pun, at the moment. Thomas's interview coming up a little bit later on. All that's come on the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are talking wages this morning. Thank you for all of your messages. That's on the back of the central bank saying that wage growth was at 7.8% over the last year. We do have a recruitment expert conveniently in the studio this morning. He's actually in to discuss his own study. Cooper Fitch is about to release its Q1 Gulf Employment Index. But his timing couldn't be better. CEO and founder of Cooper Fitch, Trevor Murphy, good morning.
Good morning, Brandy.
Before we dig into the numbers from your employment index, Trevor, let's talk about the well-paid elephant in the room, that 7.8% pay rise that the central bank has there in its quarterly report. What are you making of that?
I think it's. I mean, I haven't actually seen the detail of the report, if it includes private and public sector. I don't think it's probably too far off as an average from our side. I think we would have put it down to about 5 to 6% for last year. So I think it's reasonably accurate. Again, the detail of the audience is a little unclear at the moment.
5.6% though is still good. What's been driving that?
It's been, last year was a very busy year, probably the busiest in 3 or 4 years from a recruitment standpoint. And not every sector enjoyed that bounce, but overall, it was a very busy year. For the second half of it, back to pre-COVID numbers in terms of jobs, and then a drive on jobs, obviously, it's a helpful indicator to increase salaries. So I think overall, very good year.
And has that increased salaries on what we'd call a normal level, or has that increased salaries on the pay cuts that people had taken through the pandemic?
For the organisations that we work with, it's an increase on their salaries, not bringing them back to where they were before, yes, for sure.
And settle the argument between me and Richard, is a bonus considered part of your salary or is it not?
So we don't include it when we're calculating salary increases or reductions. We just look at gross salary. We don't include a bonus pool. We run a separate number on bonuses. It's a little ad hoc and a little more difficult to include in. In fairness to Richard, when you get a bonus, you spend that money. It is part of your salary, or it is part of your income. So I think you're both right, I hate to say.
Diplomatic. Look, let's look at your report, which is also fascinating. A near 8% increase in jobs for the UAE in Q1 is what you have calculated. Where are the new jobs, Trevor, and where are they disappearing?
So, sorry, the 7.7% or nearly 8% is across the Gulf. Mm-hmm. Some countries did not perform as well. I think UAE was still at 8%. Specifically in the UAE, I think we're seeing a real tech bubble happening at the moment. A real tech resurgence. There is massive demands around cloud, data, AI, digital, all new technologies are really, really happening at the moment across the UAE. And that's within lots of startups, but we're seeing lots of organizations build out re-centralized teams here. There's been a lot of growth in dev development and programming work, again, more specifically in Dubai. And we see a lot of public sector entities really spending quite a lot of money on hiring bigger teams to help with cyber and some big data projects. Outside of that, there's an overall good recovery across everything. We're seeing real estate starting to pop up some numbers in the UAE, but more particularly in the Northern Gulf around Qatar and Saudi. And we're seeing a good momentum across most of the markets, most of the functions that we work with.
I was interested to see in your report that you highlight two trends we've been talking about in the business breakfast, the increase in M&A activity and the IPO boom we're seeing here in the Gulf as being job creators. How big a factor are they?
I think they're so we look at them in two ways. So I guess M&A and IPO, you know, from a direct recruitment point of view, there's a lot of firm activity. And then we've got a lot of organizations that are gearing up towards IPO or investment of some kind. So it's not a massive job creator, but it's a very good economic indicator and supports that there are lots of organizations that, one, aspire to have that that investment and that growth and that expansion. And also there's a lot of interest in investing in companies across the Gulf at the moment.
Oh, Saudi dominates your report with a 16% growth in jobs in 2021. Quickly, we've got about 1 minute left with you. Is that the NEOM effect, the mega project effect, or is it beyond that?
It's probably beyond that. I mean, Saudi has been busy for the last 24 months, and that was definitely the NEOM effect. And we're definitely seeing lots of investment. There's more money being spent by public, by the big funds, PIF and the government. That's driving demand across public sector, but then that's equally forcing the private sector to step up its game and to retain its people and then to hire accordingly as well. So very busy market in Saudi at the moment.
30 seconds. What's the rest of the year going to look like job-wise, Trevor?
I think we're going to see continued growth, mid to high single-digit growth over the next three quarters. Nothing looks like that's going to slow that down. Even in the month of Ramadan, we're still very busy.
And can you find the people you need for these jobs?
It's a big challenge in some areas. It's a massive challenge in some areas. So particularly in the digital and data and cloud space, because it's not just the UAE that's looking for this talent. It's every country and most organisations within them.
Trevor Murphy, CEO and founder of Cooperfitch, in with their new Q1 Gulf Employment Index and sportingly taking our wage questions as well.
Yeah, very quickly on that. Thanks for taking part in our Twitter poll this morning at Dubai I 1038 FM. Picking up on those central bank numbers saying the average pay increase was 8% last year in the UAE. We're asking you whether or not you got a pay rise last year at your organisation. Did you get 8% or more? 0% votes. Did I get a pay rise but less than 8%? 0% votes. 83% say pay was flat. 14% say that we had pay cuts in 2021. Now, it's early days on that poll, but do please take part.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We're talking about whistleblowing.
Can you blow my whistle, baby?
And that is because Dubai Financial Services Authority has introduced new rules and regulations on whistleblowing. Delighted to be joined in the studio now by the head of enforcement at the DFSA, Patrick Meaney. Morning, Patrick.
Morning, Richard.
Talk to me about these new whistleblowing rules down in Dubai's financial centre.
So essentially, we've brought in two rules to achieve two things. First of all, to impose obligations on DFSA authorised firms to have proper whistleblowing procedures in place, and also to put in place protections for whistleblowers to avoid any detriment from whistleblowing, and to ensure that if they want their anonymity protected, that will happen. But also we've provided a mechanism whereby whistleblowers can report directly to us, and we have set up a whistleblowing hotline for that purpose, and also a process for receiving and assessing those whistleblowing reports.
So in simple terms, I'm seeing this as encouraging people who work in DIFC, in financially regulated firms, if they see something going on that they're not happy about ethically or legally, to blow the whistle, to call this hotline and to tell you what's going on. Is that over an oversimplification?
Correct. Although, I mean, we're not necessarily saying call us first. What we would hope is that firms will have proper procedures in place so that they can make the report internally first, and that it'll be dealt with properly, and that the firm will deal with it and also report it to us. But obviously, if that's not the case, or if in particular if it's a small firm in particular, if it's senior management who are the ones who are engaged in the misconduct, then in those circumstances, it may be more appropriate to direct the report straight to us.
I mean, I'd like to think for the past, it's nearly 20 years now that we've had DIFC and you guys regulating it, that we would have been encouraging and protecting whistleblowers over the past two decades. So what's changed with these new rules and regulations?
So DIFC has had a law to protect whistleblowers previously for DIFC registered firms, but I think we consider that it was good to do it for DFSA authorised firms, and to make the protections very explicit, and also to have to require firms to have explicit procedures in place, but also to do training to educate their staff about the procedures that they have, and also about their ability to make whistleblowing reports to us, and that they would be protected in doing so. And that's the most important thing, to give whistleblowers confidence that they will be protected if they make whistleblowing reports.
To what extent has this already been happening in DFSA? I mean, the example I'm obviously thinking about is Abrage, one of the largest organisations. And in some senses, it was a whistleblower who raised attention to what was going on at Abrage. Talk to me about what's happened so far in terms of examples.
Yeah, so that's a very good example. Another example is Almasa. That case involved a whistleblower as well. And so, yes, we've seen that there has been whistleblowing. I mean, what we are hoping will happen with the new regime is that we'll get those whistleblowing reports earlier in the process, so at an earlier stage in the misconduct, that people will feel more comfortable to make those reports. I mean, I think with the Abrage thing, it was, you know, right at the end when the proverbial had already hit the fan to some extent, and it was really in a very, very bad state that the whistleblowing report came through. We're hoping that we'll get that earlier. And obviously, you know, with any misconduct, the longer it goes on, the worse it gets. And that you can see, you know, people double down, they get bolder or they get more desperate. You know, Nick Leeson and Bearings is a good example of that, where as it went on, the thing got bigger and bigger. If it had been picked up earlier, it wouldn't have been a bigger problem. So that this is, I mean, I think it's about getting this information either to senior management within the organisation or to us at an earlier point, so action can be taken earlier.
What would you say to someone who's listening to this now, who's in an organisation, either in DIFC or perhaps even outside of DIFC, who thinks there's something untoward going on, but is worried about their career, is worried about what's going to happen to the reputation, who's thinking, well, what's in it for me if I do blow the whistle? What would you say to them?
Well, at the end of the day, we don't offer rewards in relation to whistleblowing, and you know, there are arguments either way on that, and I think, you know, so, but we've decided that actually it's inappropriate to be offering whistleblower rewards. So at the end of the day, it's really about having a clean conscience, and, you know, if you're seeing things going on and you're feeling uncomfortable about it ethically, it's a way to deal with that. But also at the end of the day, you're helping your own firm, because the firm is being damaged usually by the misconduct. And so if you do this, you're helping the firm, and, you know, in a good firm, you should be rewarded for that by the firm, one would hope.
Very quickly, Patrick, while you're here, it does strike me that DFSA has been very, very active in the past weeks, months and years. Okay, high-profile cases like Abrage and maybe Almasa to an extent, but others as well. I'm just looking at a couple of cases over the past few months. March of this year, DFSA imposes penalties on two Adenium firms. I hadn't heard of Adenium. Then you've got, in December last year, DFSA fines Equitativa. And in February of last year, DFSA fines, and this was an individual, Ashish Bhandari, $165,000. I could go on. They're relatively small cases, but there does seem to be a high volume of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're not that small in the grand scheme of things. But yes, we have been very busy. We've been very productive. Over the last 3 years, we have generated more than 50. There's been a more than 50% increase in the number of outcomes that we've generated, and the size of the fines which we've generated has been much greater. So the average before that was about $30,000. The average subsequently, if you exclude the Abrage individuals, which are very large fines, is about $200,000. If you include the Abrage individuals, it's over $1 million. So the amount of penalties has gone up, and that's about credible deterrence. It's really really about saying, well, you know, we started to see repetition of the same sort of misconduct. And so that indicated that actually people weren't being deterred. So it became necessary then to increase the size of the fines and also to focus on individuals. And 60% of those outcomes have been against individuals personally. And of those, 7 have been against SEOs. So we've been focusing
SEOs.
On senior executive officers, the senior, the CEO equivalent, the senior person, most senior person in the organisation, to send the message that the SEO, if there's misconduct throughout an organisation, the SEO is responsible.
Patrick, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. That's the voice of Patrick Meaney. He's the head of enforcement at Dubai Financial Services Authority, talking about, among other things, new whistleblowing regulations down in Dubai's financial centre.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Yeah, we are joined by the Emirates MBD economist Ed Bell this morning on the back of the news that UAE inflation rose to 3.3% in Q1 from pretty much flat a year ago. Those are central bank figures. Ed, good morning. It's lovely to speak to you.
Good morning.
So inflation's rising around the world. What's driving up prices here particularly?
Well, it's very much the same kind of trend that we're seeing around the world, in that higher energy costs, higher food costs, the impact of disrupted supply chains that is adding additional freight rates to anything you get imported. So all of that is feeding through into higher CPI inflation, the kind of price gains that you and I experience when we go to the grocery store, we do our kind of normal shopping here in the UAE. So after several years of very low or even negative levels of inflation, it does look like the UAE is turning around in terms of the inflation outlook.
Do you want to put in context for us, though, 3.3%, how high that is or isn't?
It is relatively high, given that we were basically at zero in the last couple of years for the UAE. But when we look at several other countries, if you look at peer economies around the region, for instance, in India, CPI is running closer to 6%, so quite a bit higher than what we experience here in the UAE. In the United States, it's closer to almost 8%. So relative to some of the other big economies, price gains are still relatively muted, but they are going to be somewhat of a difference from what we've experienced in the last few years here.
What's it going to feel like on the ground, Ed?
What we've already started to experience is probably everyone dealing with the higher cost of petrol when you're going up to fill up your own car, but also think about anything that you're getting delivered. All of those higher energy costs are being filtered through into those companies as well. So it's going to squeeze margins and probably have to put prices up for anything that comes basically on four wheels or two wheels to your house or otherwise. When you go out to do your grocery shopping, we are seeing the impact of higher food costs coming through, higher wholesale food costs coming through into the UAE as well. So all in all, it is going to be a more expensive inflation basket in the country. We're also seeing finally this sort of feed through from the higher housing costs. We've had obviously several years of declines in housing prices and rents in the UAE. That's really started to turn around from midpoint of last year. And I think anybody going through the process of negotiating rent or trying to find a new home to purchase or apartment to purchase, you'll see that house prices have gone up quite markedly, and that's going to filter through into higher inflation readings as well.
One of the factors that the central bank points to, as well as the energy costs that you mentioned earlier, imported inflation as well, is higher wages. They are putting the growth last year in wages at 7.8%. And as you can imagine, that has got Business Breakfast listeners talking this morning.
Yeah, I think that might be a reflection of what one of the listeners had commented on, that growth is really reflecting compared to 2020 levels when wages were cut across many industries quite markedly. So to look at it as though wages are increasing on a sort of organic basis, I think is perhaps a little bit is not capturing the entirety of the picture, that we sort of missed a year given how far the employment market suffered in 2020. So yes, wages are increasing. We've not really seen that in some of the latest PMI data or the near-term data that we've seen, is that employment levels are going up, but that wages are not matching the increase in employment. So we'll be watching that quite closely to see if that does persist over the coming quarters.
Just to clarify, are you suggesting that 7.8% then is filling in where wages were reduced and are coming back up to normal levels, or that we've just skipped a year in pay rises and it's effectively two in one?
No, I think that we had to endure a low level of, well, wage cuts effectively for many workers during 2020, the peak of the pandemic. And so we're sort of making up for that lost year.
So what does all of this mean for your predictions at the bank going forward? What are you predicting for inflation this year, Ed, as well as growth?
Well, we expect that inflation in the UAE is going to be closer to 4%. So again, quite a step higher than it has been in the last previous years. If we look at 2021, for instance, CPI growth was basically neutral or flat, and it was negative in 2020. So it is going to feel markedly more expensive and probably accelerating over the next couple of quarters as we endure the impact of higher imported costs for particularly food, for energy prices going up as well. On growth, however, though, we are still fairly resilient or robust in terms of our own expectations for this year. So we expect to see growth in the UAE, headline GDP growth, at 5.7%. Now, what behind that is about 4% growth in the non-oil sector. So still relatively strong levels of growth there, but also very strong levels of growth in the oil sector as the UAE adds production back to the market. So we're targeting around 10% growth in oil production in the UAE this year.
Ed Bell, Senior Director for Market Economics at Emirates NBD. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Talking about the economics of private jets now, delighted to be joined on the Business Breakfast, making his debut on the show, the founder and chairman of Dubai-based private jet company VistaJet. He is Thomas Fleur. Thomas, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Can we talk first of all about this deal that you've done in the past week? Privately held Vista has acquired the private aviation services platform of the US charter operator Jet Edge. It's described as your seventh acquisition in the past 4 years. What's going on?
Yeah, that's correct. We see unprecedented demand around the world in every different region. Here in the Middle East, we nearly doubled over the last 18 months. And there is a transformational shift in this industry from asset heavy to asset light. And we're offering this subscription model where very simply we identify the number of hours you need as a corporation. And rather than having to buy a business jet, you just take the hours. And to satisfy this demand needs us to do acquisitions. Manufacturers are sold out for a couple of years, so you can't go to them. And these acquisitions provide us with that additional lift, that additional infrastructure to satisfy that demand.
So, Thomas, let's take a step back. As I mentioned, it's the first time we're speaking to you on the Business Breakfast. Give us the potted history of VistaJet. It started nearly two decades ago now. You're from Europe. That's where you made your name and made your money. But Vista is now based in Dubai. Give us the quick version of that story.
Look, I was an unsatisfied user of this industry, and I always scratched my head that you didn't really know what you get when you chartered an airplane. It's obviously quite expensive. You charter maybe through a broker. You arrive at the airport and you don't really get know what product you're getting. And if you look at any other industry selling to the wealthiest and the most influential people in the world, it's all about a brand. And it was my vision that if one were to build an infrastructure, a global infrastructure of identical business aircraft, and just simply offer this on a subscription basis, that this would satisfy demand and change the industry. And that's exactly what I've done. We created Vista, the silver aircraft with a red stripe. Every single aircraft is identical in its interior. The flight attendants are trained with the British Butler Institute, and so on and so forth. So wherever you are around the globe, 24/7, 365, at shortest notice, simply go on the app and you book a Vista airplane. And in the remotest location, you will get a Vista airplane. But for that, you needed a global infrastructure. So as we were building out this infrastructure today, we have arrived at about 350 aircraft around the globe. And it was in 2018 that we said we really need to be in a business location allowing us to access most of the world in the most efficient way. And we've did a very diligent study, and it came down to that the DIFC here in Dubai offers that center point, that a friendly business infrastructure. And ever since we're here, we have our headquarters here, and we're extremely happy with what the government is offering us.
You've said previously that you want to remove what you call the Hollywood image of private aviation, which is someone living the high life, sitting in a private jet with a bubbly beverage in their hand. You say it's something different than that. Explain that to me.
Yeah, I'm very glad you did all the research. That's exactly right. This business jet offering is a business tool. It's probably the most efficient business tool for the C-level of a company. Think about it, flying point to point from a remotest location to the remotest location, no check-in queues, straight on the aircraft. You arrive at the airport, within 10 minutes you're airborne, and then maybe on the same day or the next morning fly back to your headquarters. It's that usage of your time. You know, we're having every single aircraft equipped with the highest speed internet, so you can have your video conferences, your connection with your office with high speed internet, and it really allows you to be so efficient that as a company, the C-level is gaining time and efficiency, and that's really what we offer. This is about businesses being efficient and running them on a global scale, and that's the infrastructure we provide on a global basis.
Well, let's talk about cost. Give me an example. For if we look at the busiest air routes in the world at the moment, a lot of them are out of Dubai. Dubai, London is one of them. But I'm particularly interested in Dubai to Riyadh into Saudi Arabia. If I was a part of the Vista Jets program, what's it going to cost me to get one of your jets to Riyadh tomorrow and back, for example?
Look, it really depends what aircraft you would choose. You can use the industry-leading Global 7500 all the way down to a Challenger. And this is the alternative we offer with our infrastructure. Just use the aircraft you really need from a size point of view, from a range point of view. And we even offer seat sharing on our app. So a little bit like the Uber share concept. We have brought so much technology to this industry. So in simple answer, you know, if you use a smaller Challenger aircraft on a two-hour flight, so this is probably going to be like $25,000. If you now share this seat with a couple of other members of our subscription business model, you can probably bring this down to somewhere between $10,000 and $12,000.
So what happens next for VistaJet? You've clearly built a significant organization. Was it 350 planes you mentioned there? What's it going to look like in 5 years' time, Thomas?
Well, we see this transformational shift from asset-heavy to asset-light. The addressable market is 22,000 corporate jets in the world. So think about it. We only, although it sounds like a big number, we have 350 aircraft. If this trend continues, which we believe it does, that corporations don't want to go to the board and say and ask for a $20 million or $50 million CapEx expense, they simply want to go through a travel expense, OPEX versus CapEx. I think we continue to take market share from full or fractional ownership. And without throwing numbers around, but we have a track record that we are doubling about every 3 years. And I see this trend continuing, given the demand signals we're getting from around the globe.
Thomas, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thomas Fleur, founder and chairman of Dubai-based VistaJet.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.